that, I'd like to introduce our first panel conversation, which is Policy Driving Action. And this is going to be facilitated by Eugenia Gibbons, who is the Policy Director of the Green Energy Consumers Alliance. Eugenia.
So actually, can all the panelists come up? Do you want me there or here?
Janet, would you like all the panelists to come up? Would you like her to speak here?
Oh, you can sit, take any order. We have a lot of ground to cover in a tight hour, so we're going to jump right in. And while my panelists take a seat, I just want to quickly introduce myself. I am Eugenia Gibbons. I'm the Policy Director at Green Energy Consumers Alliance. And I'm really delighted to be here today. Can someone adjust the slides for me? So I wanted to take a moment to set the context for the discussion that we're about to have. As we heard this morning, we have an imperative to act on climate, and we don't have time to waste. So one of the things that we'll be focusing on today is the progress that's been made in the 10 years since the Global Warming Solutions Act was passed. It's Massachusetts' landmark, previously nation-leading legislation or law that requires that Massachusetts reduce emissions 25% below 1990 levels by 2020 and at least 80% by 2050. If you could go to the slide, please. So the graph on the right illustrates where Massachusetts, the black dotted line going up to the top is business as usual, and the blue line that's sort of declining indicates where we are in terms of, or where we're projected to be in terms of reaching that 2020 target, that little green square at the bottom. A lot of focus has been placed on whether or not we'll hit that first target, but obviously the real meaty part of the conversation is what do we do when we get past 2020, because it's kind of irrelevant if we hit the 2020 target or not. So there are significant gaps that exist in our ability to ratchet down emissions. And we heard this morning that the science really tells us that we have to be even more aggressive than we previously were. So as our panelists will speak today, there's a role for all of us to play in this pursuit of reduced emissions. But policy has a particularly important role because it really sets the trajectory that will put Massachusetts on, that will be putting Massachusetts on to achieve emission reductions, to hit our climate goals, and to pull the other states in the region and the rest of the country along. So good policy can enable a more aggressive pursuit of climate action. It can also ensure that we are achieving reductions. But we are certainly in a time of political inertia and federal inaction, which means that states really do have to lead by example. They have to lead on policy design, on program implementation, because we need to demonstrate at the state level, which includes local activity that's informing state activity, we have to demonstrate what's possible. So implementation occurs at every level. As I noted, everyone has a role to play. Legislators, members of the executive branch in the administration, regional planning agencies, advocates, and organizers on the ground, all of those perspectives are represented on this panel today. And we're going to talk a little bit about what each of us, or each of these individuals, is doing to help make sure that Massachusetts doesn't miss the mark. So we're going to dive right in. And I'm going to ask each panelist to introduce themselves with the first question, which is, who are you? And what are you doing to help drive policy action in Massachusetts? And we can begin right here with Carol Oldham. Next slide, please.
Hi, everybody. I'm Carol Oldham. I'm the executive director of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. And we are an organization with chapters in cities and towns across Massachusetts. We represent more than 100 communities in Massachusetts. And we work at both the local level and the state level. And Our chapters are doing a lot of local solutions in their communities. A lot of that is via town meeting, a lot of bylaws, that where they are trying to solve climate change on the community level to provide an example for the state and for the nation. So on the local level, we help the local chapters work better and connect to each other and replicate the good work that is happening from one community to another. On the state level, we work on policy that makes the local work better and more possible, and we try to scale up good solutions. So our point of view is that individual action is very nice, but it's not going to get us where we need to be, and collective action is really important. Next slide, please. So the campaigns that we are working on right now, we have a big net zero planning push where we're helping a lot of communities do net zero planning and think about how they can set a goal and figure out what they need to do to get there and how they can include their communities. We are also working a lot on buildings, which I know is a big emphasis this afternoon. This is actually an example of how state policy needs to let communities lead. So a lot of communities are trying to do net zero planning, and they've realized that they can't actually require the buildings in their communities to be net zero. So we have a bill that is a net zero stretch code bill, and that is an opportunity for to allow communities to lead. But we are also looking to improve the base code for everybody in the nation. And then we're working a lot on community choice aggregation in communities, and I want to voice an unpopular opinion right now, which is that you guys are all covered by the Cape Light Compact, which could have a lot more renewable energy. We just worked with Lowell to get 45% additional clean energy over and above the renewable portfolio standard. So Cape Light Compact is doing a lot of amazing work, but they're lagging behind. And I know they're in this room. They're lagging behind on the high on clean energy. And so I just want to encourage everybody to work in your communities to provide the support that Maggie needs to see from the communities to do better.
Good morning. I'm Christy Senatore. I'm the executive director for the Cape Cod Commission. We are the regional planning and economic development agency for the region. And we all are here because we recognize that climate change is a critical challenge for the Cape. Climate change is here today. We are facing impacts to our region as we speak. And to set the stage, we're a data-driven organization. And we recognize that we have 586 miles of vulnerable coastline. And that's at risk from flooding and erosion today. Climate change, sea level rise will only further exacerbate the risks that we're facing as a region. 20% of the Cape's land mass is in a special flood hazard area. And this accounts for about $16 billion worth of property value and about 1,500 historic structures. So making the Cape less vulnerable has been a focus of the Cape Cod Commission's work to date, and addressing and crafting policies and strategies that can address our evolving shoreline address climate change and coastal storms has been a priority and will continue to be a priority for the Commission. Over the course of the past several years, we've engaged with stakeholders across the region on a coastal resilience program and have developed an online decision support tool, capecodcoast.org. And I'd encourage you to visit this website and take a look at some of the strategies that can be implemented along our vulnerable coastlines. And it gives the user an opportunity to look at the socioeconomic impacts of some of these strategies as well. We've also significantly updated our regional policy plan, our comprehensive economic development strategy, and our regional transportation plan over the course of the past year. And all of these plans now take a look at the region in terms of climate change and coastal resilience and the need for us to balance the economy and the environment. So we'll continue to work with stakeholders across the region, but it's also important to recognize and identify that it takes many people and it takes many layers of government at all levels, public sector, private sector, nonprofits, to really have an impact. And participation in implementing effective policies and strategies from all levels is important. And so it's really a pleasure to see all the leadership in the room engaged around this issue.
Hello, Hello, everyone. My name is Han Chu. I'm with the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs, and I manage the Global Warming Solutions Implementation Program. What our program does is we coordinate with state agencies on ways to plan, do policy planning, policy implementation, and policy progress evaluation so that we are meeting the greenhouse gas reduction targets in the Global Warming Solutions Act. And so part of our work for the policy planning side is developing portfolios of policies for us to meet the 2020 emissions target, make recommendations to the EEA secretary on interim targets for 2030, 2040, and as well as coming up with like a roadmap to 2050. Part of our, a big part of our effort right this second is, and for the next year plus, is the 80 by 50 study, which some of you may have heard of. Basically, it's a study to help the Commonwealth figure out what are the pathways, what are the policies to get to at least 80% reduction. We want to make sure that the study help us get to the 2050 emissions target strategically, equitably, and cost-effectively. And so we hired CADMIS and the CADMIS team to help us with this research effort. But we are also looking to do a lot of stakeholder engagement. And so me being here is one part of it, but we'll definitely have additional stakeholder engagement events in the upcoming months and year for you all to find out more about the study and engage.
So good morning, everyone. I'm State Senator Jamie Eldridge, and very honored and really appreciate being invited to be at this conference and to be on this panel. Especially pleased to be here with my friends and colleagues, Senator Julian Sear and Representative Dylan Fernandez. I work particularly closely with Julian as member of the Senate Progressive Caucus, and both of them have very quickly become leaders on climate change. I am in my sixth term as a state senator, and I'm particularly glad that Eugenia is moderating this because just a couple months ago, I was moderating a panel that she was on the Green New Deal, the Democratic State Convention. So we're switching roles a little bit. But I want to thank Jim Wolf for inviting me and continue to be close friends with former State Senator Dan Wolf, who's here in the audience and I know is a co-sponsor of the conference. In terms of, I'm just going to talk briefly about some of the bills that I filed. I serve as the Senate Chair of the Clean Energy Caucus, and so we've put together a number of priority bills. But the bills I was just going to mention, the first one is actually before I talk about the bills, I want to highlight that the Senate right now, and this is really led by Senator Mike Barrett, who's the Senate Chair of the Telecommunications, Utility, and Energy Committee, is crafting a comprehensive Senate climate change bill. So the Senate just recently passed a very robust education bill, and so I really see our next step is passing a strong climate change bill. The Senate did pass a very comprehensive bill last session, so I don't know how much it will be like that. It might have different components. I think one of the really exciting things this session is just so many more legislators are filing bills around clean energy and climate change. So it's beyond just sort of a small group of legislators, and that's very exciting. Some of the bills that I have filed, one of them is Senate 1958, an act transitioning Massachusetts to 100% renewable energy. That is a stronger goal than net zero because it's not just looking to get to net zero, but it's saying that all of our energy needs, whether you know our homes, transportation, et cetera, should be moved to 100% renewable energy by 2045. Right now, there's several other states that have passed similar laws, including Hawaii, California, New Mexico, Nevada, Washington, and Maine, in New York, which are actually just recent. So this is challenging and directing the DOER and Department of Transportation to come up with specific goals to be enforceable to get to 100% renewable energy by 2045. So I filed that piece of legislation. I think Linda maybe had mentioned it is around making sure that every community benefits from clean energy, and also that we're avoiding the past practices of putting dirty power plants, incinerators, et cetera, in poor communities, working class communities, communities of color. So I've also filed my environmental justice bill, and that's Senate 464. And it would basically create a clear standard for environmental justice, create a more robust public hearing process, and Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Quite honestly, it's really designed so that we don't build any more dirty power plants. You know, if you go up to Lawrence, if you go to Haverhill, if you go to a place like Southbridge, where you have the state's largest landfill, there's a reason that those, you know, landfills, incinerators, power plants are going to communities like that and not, you know, more well-off communities. We really need to stop that. And that not only benefits those communities, but it benefits the whole state. And then I have also filed a couple bills around solar. So a newer bill that I filed with a couple of House colleagues is an act increasing solar rooftop energy. So right now, and this sort of speaks a little bit to what Carol talked about the building code, is that we don't have a statewide building code that says that every home or building that's built, that the roofs have to be built so that solar can immediately be put on and you don't have to have a homeowner or business owner, you know, expend the money to adapt that roof. So this would require, through the building code, that all homes and buildings would have to be roof solar rooftop ready. And then the final bill that I've filed is Senate 1955, an act relative to solar power and green economy, and that eliminates the net metering cap. That's a big frustration across the state. I represent a Metro West district where many of my communities, because of the utility that services many of my communities, has already reached the net metering cap, and that means that homes, buildings can't go forward with their solar projects. So this would eliminate the net metering cap. There's no rational reason for the net metering cap, so it would eliminate that, and that would, you know, free up solar for across the state and move, you know, more investment into clean energy and away from fossil fuels. So look forward to the discussion, and once again, thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Good morning. Julian Sear. I'm the state senator for the Cape and Islands District. This includes 20 communities across Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, the Elizabeth Islands. It's so nice to be with all of you. I look around the room, and this is just, on this issue and almost any issue, these are the folks that I go to and I work with on big challenges we face here. And there's no real challenge that's sort of bigger or more existential than climate disruption and what a changing climate is already meaning for our communities and what is going to mean for our communities. You know, our way of life, how we, where we go, where we shop, where we eat, what we do is going to be changing, you know, in our lives, is changing and will be changing in our lifetimes. And I think the, you know, I don't know if, I hope most folks saw the really excellent piece the Boston Globe did around, you know, a changing climate and what that looks like here on Cape Cod. And I was fortunate to be, you know, to participate in kind of the rollout of this. We're going to have to make decisions in our communities in the next 10 or 20 years, you know, that we thought we'd have to make in 100 years. And that requires just the heaviest of lifts, and it really requires leadership. And so I'm grateful to have you folks all here. In the Massachusetts legislature, I represent more coastline than any other legislator by far. I probably represent some of the most coastline of any state-level lawmaker in the country. Dylan is first in the House. And, you know, it's not, you know, we particularly have a challenge here. And it's not every day that you open up the New York Times and you see a municipality that you represent, you know, in the case of Barnstable, being the second or third highest cost per resident to address climate change. We're fortunate to have really strong leadership here in Massachusetts, and I'm thrilled to have Jamie here, who's someone who's been pushing the envelope on this issue when we didn't have the consensus that I think we have today. What I've sought to do in my role as a bill filer is to look at the specific policies where we haven't made, we haven't been able to make some progress. Some of that's really specific, wonky stuff. I've been working on legislation as it relates to historic districts, which we have a plethora of, including the largest contiguous historic district in the country, which is the Old Kings Highway Historic District along Route 6A. And this is actually an issue Sheila Place brought to me, and we've been working on, and there's some tweaks to this, but really, that we need some legal framework to frankly compel historic districts that they need to look at both moving towards more renewable energy as far as solar panels on roofs and a whole host of things, that their tasks are not just going to be historic preservation, but also how do you preserve and ensure there's even a building, a structure, a downtown to even be in. Also focused with Dylan on legislation called community empowerment. This would give municipalities the ability to enter into contracts to purchase renewable energy, to essentially be able to invest in that. So you could vote at town meeting to essentially say, hey, look, I want to be investing in renewable energy with my energy dollars that all of you are paying. This is something actually we haven't been able to get done, despite actually really strong support in both the Senate and the House. And so I think to me this illustrates how surprisingly difficult it is to still advance some common sense good policies just here in Massachusetts. There's some other legislation we're working on, and I think we'll get into it later in the panel. I would just close by saying I think it's really important as Cape Codders and as Islanders to be really honest about what we face. And I think that we've also got to be really honest about the NIMBYism that we have in our community. I look at every big challenge we face in this region, and whether it's housing or climate disruption, maybe less so on bridges, this not in my backyard mentality has to stop. And we're not going to have a peninsula to live on if we don't get serious about having wind turbines off our shores, having solar panels in our historic districts, allowing people to live next to us in maybe slightly denser units. And this is the conversation that needs to happen on Cape Cod. And we've been bad at that conversation. We've let the NIMBY folks and that dialogue win time and again. It has to stop, and if it doesn't stop, we're just not going to have a place to live, or at least my generation is not going to have a place to live. And so I think that, I think of the call to action of this group, and I think of the real encouragement of where we're going, that's the conversations that we need to have. That's the leadership we need to really cultivate. And it's hard work, right, because we're making most of these decisions, town by town, neighbor to neighbor. So it means it's twice as much work, but you also have a lot of opportunity to move hearts and minds. So it's great to be here with you today. Also, too, I don't know how this panel became so gendered, gender split, but I think
it's bad facilitation on my part.
No. I think it speaks to the fact that we need more women to run for public office. So run.
Hi, I'm Dylan Fernandez. I'm the state rep for Falmouth, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket. Apologize for the nasally voice. I've been actually sick since Saturday. I feel a little better today. It's my first time out of the house in 4 days, so great way to start it off with all of you. I come at this from a couple of different lenses, one lens being representing more coastline than any other state rep in Massachusetts, and then the other one just coming at this from a millennial, and my generation and my children's generation will be more impacted by climate change than any other. It's the biggest issue that we face, and it's an existential threat to future generations. And so, when you look at the numbers, they're really daunting. I mean, if every single country hits their goals that they set forth in the Paris Climate Agreement, we'll get to 3.3 degrees of warming. Of course, that's Celsius, because everyone else uses Celsius. And if we get there, large swaths of the planet will just be uninhabitable, and it'll have countless negative effects in terms of air quality, sea level rise, pollution, health effects that will cost billions, if not trillions and trillions of dollars. And those are things that my generation is going to be paying for, and those are the effects that are going to impact my generation. If we stay on our current trajectory, we're going to hit 4.5 degrees of warming by roughly the end of my lifetime, probably when my kids, if I have kids, are in their 20s. And our planet's gone through five mass extinctions. Four of them were because of global warming that was set off by the release of carbon emissions. One, of course, was, you know, an asteroid, but the other ones were global warming set off by carbon emissions. And while those events played out over millennia, this one is literally playing out within my generation and my children's generation. So if we don't tackle this now, we're going to, in effect, destroy our planet by the time my children are kind of at the end of their lifetime. And we really haven't done much on this. We really haven't done anything, frankly. You know, the first UN climate report on this came out, I believe it was like the I think it was like 91, 92. The Woods Hole, I see Woods Hole Research Center people here that can correct me on it. You know, Hansen testified in Congress in the late 80s on this. So since that time, we have released more carbon into the atmosphere than any other time before that. So we have not only done nothing since it's become known that this is a problem, but we have been knowingly and complicitly killing ourselves and more devastatingly future generations for the past 45 years, and we've only been doing it at an accelerated rate. So, you know, I think that's why, like, I feel really pissed off about this, and I think that's why you see a lot of millennials and now Generation Z coming up behind us who are just furious. And, you know, Greta, I'm going to butcher the last name, Thunberg, you know, has really been at the forefront of this movement, because you have, you know, two generations saying, look, like adults, grown-ups, and I guess, you know, we're there now, but we're still millennials. But, you know, you guys are if we're going to keep going at the current status quo or keep only making incremental changes, we're going to literally leave an uninhabitable planet for future generations. So, you know, that's kind of the perspective I bring to it. You know, in terms of legislation, we can get into that. But we filed a community empowerment together. I filed a bill taxing carbon, which I think is the most important thing we can do to address to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. There's a number of legislative proposals I've co-sponsored. Most of Jamie's I've co-sponsored the House side of it. And so there's just a lot of legislative fixes that we can do. The thing that I've probably spent the most time on is deep water offshore wind. So I'd be happy to get into that and how that's really, I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to addressing climate change, our commitment to doing deep water offshore wind utility scale, now an authorization of up to 3,200 megawatts, has been the most impactful thing that we've done as a state in terms of Massachusetts led on this, and now you see tens of thousands of megawatts procurements from states up and down the East Coast that lead to will lead to an actual real impact in the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. So we can get into a lot more of this stuff, but I'll stop right there.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. So as you can see, we have a panel full of people who are doing really important work to move us forward. The first question I'm actually going to, you know, we can start with Senator Sear and Rep. Fernandez, but it's open to everybody. The GWSA targets were set at a time when science indicated that at least 80% would be sufficient. You've just spoken, Dylan, about how we now know that that is not the case. So this is a two-part question. One is, is there an appetite within the legislature to see that target modified and to be made more stringent? If so, is it 2050? Is it 2030? What do we need to be looking at? And given that you both represent districts that are experiencing the impacts of climate change in the moment, right now, what are you doing or what support do you need to compel your colleagues in the State House to move with greater urgency to address both these issues?
Well, first of all, I sure hope so. We're going to update these targets and have them be, you know, science-based. Here's sort of the lay of the land of what things look like this session. So we've actually seen some action usually in the Senate and Dan will appreciate this as well. You know, the Senate in Massachusetts likes to lead as the progressive body and nudge our House colleagues along. In this actually issue, the House has actually gone first. And they passed $1 billion. So we look at when we look at the climate needs, right? We're looking at adaptation and mitigation. They passed $1 billion adaptation and mitigation bill, $100 million over 10 years. They actually did this before the August recess. I think that's promising. I've got a few little sort of critiques of that. Basically, they're using bonding money opposed to actual authorization, so there's not a dedicated revenue stream for this. But I think that's a really good first step. Governor Baker as well actually has led on this and put out a proposal, I think one of the first proposals we've seen from this governor, around actually having a revenue stream for climate adaptation and mitigation, and that's through a doubling of the deeds excise tax, which I think is something that all three of us really welcomed that proposal being on the table. The governor, too, that is about $100 million over 10 years, so also a billion mark. I think we need both of that, right? We've got such a big problem. We need you know, at least $200 million over the next 10 years. You know, I think it's really important that we have a dedicated revenue stream, and maybe we do a both and, right? We take the House's proposal, we take the Senate's proposal, the governor's proposal, and maybe we'll see what that's what we'll do in the Senate. I think that just the challenge we face is so big, but I think it's really important that we have, like, dedicated revenue for this. And without dedicated revenue, you know, we passed last session a $2.4 billion environmental bond authorization that has a whole host of really good things in it, and the vast majority of those dollars hasn't even been released yet. So I think, one, you folks should be asking this administration to release those dollars. There's a whole host of things in that bond authorization that'll make a big difference for Cape Codders and for Islanders. And then I think, two, working around the political conversation about, all right, we need to have a revenue stream for this issue. And I think some of this may be around transportation and carbon pricing. And there's actually a regional effort being looked at, which I think has some promise across states. But also, I think doubling of the deeds excise tax, it's certainly not going to be popular in sort of the real estate community. I think artfully, though, you know, it does, you know, it is sort of tied to the problem we face, right? If we don't address this, we're going to actually see ultimate decrease in our property values. I mean, just ask anyone who's trying to sell a very waterfront home in Martha's Vineyard. We have a number of these. On the Outer Cape, we have a number of these. You can't do it, right, because it's ultimately not worth anything. That actually ends up hurting our towns, right, because that's where our municipal tax base is coming from. So that conversation about revenue is really, really important, and it's not just enough to, we need to borrow a little bit for this, but we need a revenue stream, and I think that's what folks need to be, all of you need to be pushing.
So before we get another response, so in addition to revenue, is there any thought to goal setting and making targets more stringent? From anybody on the panel, but sure. Especially gentlemen in the legislature.
Yeah, I think I definitely think there's very strong support to update the emissions goals since the Global Warming Solutions Act became law in 2008. So, you know, I mentioned a number of other states, including most recently Maine and New York, that have, you know, established much bolder goals. So I feel very strongly that I think that that's something that could pass in the legislature this session. There's a number of different bills. I know another bill that's been talked about a little bit, I think it's filed by Representative Joe Machino, is the Roadmap 2050 bill. So that's another approach to reduce emissions. So I think there's definitely strong support, and I do think it's important for people who are really concerned about climate change that when you're, you know, reaching out to your state representatives and state senators, to make sure that, you know, you communicate the change, you know, updating the framework is critical.
Excellent. Thank you.
So just briefly on that, there's a couple of bills that update it. The Roadmap to 2050 by Machino, that was filed. That was in front of, I sit on the Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy Committee. That's a bill that's in front of that committee. Representatives Decker and Garbley also filed 100% by 2050 legislation that updates that formula. And so, that's another bill in front of the committee. We've all co-sponsored those bills. And then just on the piece that the House passed, So there's a bunch of language in there on adaptation, but there's also some language in there on mitigation. And so there's money in there for it's mostly filtered through municipalities. It's very municipality focused. And so there's there'd be money in there for towns to hire an energy coordinator to help make their town more resilient and energy efficient. There's money in there for towns to electrify their vehicle fleets and update the EV reimbursement that was actually just cut. And then there's also money in there around towns being able to funding for microgrids for towns to become more energy efficient as well. So it's not just adaptation. There are mitigation measures in there, and it's not the only thing that the House is going to do this year around energy and the environment, and the Speaker has been clear on that, although we have a long way to go.
That's great. I'll get back to more EV, but before I do, so legislative activity is one important way to move policy, but we do also have to implement things. I'm curious, Han, I know you mentioned that the state is in the process of developing a roadmap to 2050, and that will inform a 2030 goal-setting exercise. Can you speak a little bit about what opportunities exist for this administration in that planning process to turn some of the recommendations that have already been made in the reports that were previously released this year? There's a Future of Transportation report. There's also a comprehensive energy plan. What efforts will be made by the administration to turn those recommendations into actions that are laid out in the planning process?
Thanks for that question. So the 80 by 50 study, I like to think it's a pretty comprehensive study where we're looking at not just pathways to getting to at least 80% reduction, but also looking at the uncertainties from now into the future of how policies, certain types of policies might hold up or not, or federal inaction might require certain types of state policies or regional collaboration. And then there's also policy analysis, which is a big component of the study, where we not only do we want to have a portfolio of policies and how those policies can get us to greenhouse gas reductions, we want to understand how these policies are affecting residents. Because, again, the three tenets that I said is strategic, equitable, and cost-effective. So we want to make sure that policies that are going to be recommended in the roadmap or included in the roadmap to 2050 have analysis on how different groups of people are impacted. So the recommendation in the Future of Transportation and the comprehensive energy plans, those will be fed, those are being fed into the study so that we understand what are the impacts on those policies on everyday Americans' lives in terms of their costs, the cost that they have to bear in terms of the public health impacts, in terms of the other benefits like job access and distribution. And so, I like to think that we are taking those recommendations and analyzing it to the nitty-gritty level so that we can make a more informed decision.
Great, thank you. Well, Christy, you're in the business of also developing plans, but really implementing on the ground and turning recommendations into something that is actually being done. Can you speak a little bit more about the role of regional planning agencies like the Cape Cod Commission in assisting communities in planning for and pursuing GHG emission reduction goals, specifically with regard to mitigation? We heard this morning from Dr. Carter, reducing emissions is really sort of where we need to begin. So can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. And that is a great suggestion to talk about, because it's really important that we implement a lot of the recommendations that are in the regional plans that I mentioned earlier. And one of those is establishing a baseline for greenhouse gas emissions. That's something that's critical to measuring our performance as we move forward. It was really nice to hear Janet mention the data-driven needs of the region, and this is something that really is an exercise that needs to be completed for the region. So we are at the Commission underway with establishing a methodology to actually complete a greenhouse gas emissions inventory for the region. And that will help us as we move forward, not only looking at adaptation, but mitigation strategies and what will be the most successful to implement across the Cape, and working with our 15 communities, but recognizing that these aren't individual community issues, it's really an issue that impacts impacts the Cape as a region.
So am I correct in understanding that there, although the Massachusetts maintains a greenhouse gas emissions database statewide, there's nothing that drills down at the regional level?
Right.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I can elaborate on that. The Massachusetts greenhouse gas inventory that's maintained and annually updated by Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, they use a lot of federal data sets, like the SEDS data sets, EIA. So there is some aggregation of data at the state level. It's really hard to break it down to the regional level. And then you talk about transportation emissions that crisscross county boundaries, let alone town boundaries. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very hard to bring it down to a regional level. So I commend the effort, and we'll try to support the effort however much we can, but it's a daunting task.
So it sounds like it's a good opportunity for the Cape Cod Commission and the Cape Cod region to really lead by example and demonstrate what's possible, since our policies need to be data-driven. Carol, question for you. Going back to the discussion of net zero and how we get there, you mentioned the work that you do with communities to commit to net zero. Can you describe really briefly what that means when a community commits to net zero? And then what are the ways that communities can really move forward in achieving the goal, and what barriers might they encounter in addition to what you already mentioned about building codes that require state intervention?
Sure. So first, I just want to say, in response to some of what's been said, that I think the time for low-hanging fruit is over. We are past that moment. We need to do a lot more. We need to set our goals a lot higher. We need to think a lot more ambitiously. So I think that communities are leading the way with their net zero planning. A lot of them are actually thinking about how can they be net zero as a community prior to 2050. I think that's really important. And basically what that means for a community is that they are not putting out any emissions by whatever their goal date is. And I think that there are things that communities have control over, and there are things that they do not have control over. And some of that can be fixed at the state legislative level by giving them access to things like a net zero stretch code, but some of it is going to have to happen with the state's planning. And I am hopeful that the 80% by 2050 plan will also include a scenario that is 100% by 2050, and what are the pathways to get there. I know that that has been requested from the administration, and I know, as you pointed out, that it's at least 80% by 2050, but we really need to look at what the 100% scenario is, because the last 20% is the hardest part, right? We all know that. I think that the, there are things like transportation that need to be dealt with to some degree at the state level. You can do things like change your fleets, but we need to be thinking about how transit can better serve everybody. I think that one thing about that is, to the planning perspective, if we plan our communities better, if we plan them the way that they used to be planned, you don't have to get in your car for absolutely everything. You can walk to your neighbor's house. I used to live in New Mexico. I had to get in the car to walk my dog. So we don't want communities like that, right? Like, we want to be connected to our neighbors. We want to be able to walk to the grocery store. That is really important to how we live our lives. That improves our quality of life. And so I think just thinking about that at the community level, how can we plan our community so that people's lives are better and more sustainable? Because those two things actually go together. It improves our quality of life to be more sustainable.
Okay. Yeah, if I can respond to you, Carol. So there's a little misnomer when I said 80 by 50 study. People think that, oh, we're just looking at 80%. No, just wanted to, clarify that we are looking at how we can reach at least 80% reduction. And that, other states haven't done, is that we are including the land sector in our analysis. And so the 80% reduction that is in the GWSA are gross emissions. That's coming from building sector, electric sector, transportation sector, and the waste non-energy sector. But that hasn't factored in the land sector, basically biosequestration in our forests and other managed working lands in the wetlands, et cetera. And so our study is incorporating that and seeing how much sequestration potential can happen from now until then in different cases, like a baseline case or like a case where we increase active management practices to further pull carbon from the air through biological processes. So just wanted to say that with the land sector in there, we can definitely get much more closer to net zero. Without the land sector, we won't be able to get to net zero. So just wanted to clarify that. And so there will be kind of like 80 plus pathway, and then for us to then explore how we can get to net zero, where with the land sector, we can get down to 100% reduction.
I just want to chime in on the local piece, you know, that Carol was talking about, because I think this is really important, and particularly for us here in Massachusetts and on Cape Cod, we have a highly decentralized system of local government, right? So Massachusetts has 351 distinct municipalities. Most states do this kind of level of work at the county level, or even higher. And so, yes, it's really important that we're pushing for, you know, the state to be getting to net zero, that we're advancing a whole host of policies, but we're leaving a big thing on the table if we're not talking about the local role here. You know, yes, it's helpful if the state or the Cape Cod Commission comes out with, you know, a stretch building code or a model building, green building code, right? But that's something you can implement in your towns today. And so I think it really matters who is serving on your select boards, who's serving on your planning boards, and getting engaged locally. We can do a lot of work there. And I think it's easier to focus at the state level it's hard to focus at the national level at the moment. But right, we often look for, all right, what's the big solution here? And yeah, we got to keep our eye on that. But if we're leaving out the local piece, especially here, we're actually not going to make a lot of progress because, you know, we can have a model code at the state level, but how many towns are actually implementing it? And so that's what I just want to really encourage folks to think of as well. Is like, yeah, you got to hold us accountable and really push us at the state level, but you also got to really push at the local level. And because of how our local government is structured, folks are also really responsive to this. Like 10 people show up at a select board meeting, you bet it's going to be on their agenda. So I just want to put a plug in there for really pushing at the hyper-local level. By the way, there's a parallel in this on housing, so push there too.
Yeah. 10 adults or a couple of really cute kids are also effective.
Yep.
So switching focus just a little bit, someone mentioned, Dylan, you mentioned Mori V and how that expired last week. Mori V was the state's only direct incentive to help consumers get into electric vehicles. Massachusetts has very ambitious targets for getting EVs on the road. I'm curious if anybody from the legislature has updates on where things might, or even Han, if you have an update from the administration on where things might be moving with the rebate money and replenishing that resource.
So, excuse me. So, you know, our transportation sector is, you know, our largest emitter in Massachusetts, and you guys hear me? And there has been, so I think, you know, in terms of replenishing the more EV money, that's something that's looked at in, as I mentioned before, in the Green Works legislation, and then also, it's also, you know, there's also incentives in there and rebates in there for local municipalities to move their fleet to 100% electric. There's a number of bills. I actually met Eugenia at an EV briefing in the State House, I don't know, last week, 2 weeks ago. And so there's a number of pieces of legislation to address it. The House Chair of the Telecommunications Utilities and Energy Committee has filed a number of these bills. And so I would suspect that we'll see them get out of committee that he chairs and probably push forward this year. When it comes to, so there's that piece, but I also want to talk about the local piece too. And in particularly my district, because I represent islands, right? And when you think about, you know, sustainability on the local level, for my district, you know, we have the first all-electric RTA in the state on Martha's Vineyard. It's all-electric bus system. That's something that, you know, a lot of people partnered on to make work, but they did get a sizable state grant that we helped push for. And then, okay, but how do you get to the vineyard? Well, you gotta take a boat, right? And turns out those boats emit a lot of greenhouse gases and they use a whole lot of fuel. So so this past August, I took a trip to Denmark and toured an offshore wind farm and then also toured an all-electric ferry. And it's a ferry that goes 2.5 miles from Denmark to Sweden, and it runs on entirely electric power. And so that is something that, you know, that is something that the Steamship Authority really needs to be changing and really needs to be adopting. So I've had a number of meetings with them on this, and then we have a meeting actually scheduled next week with a bunch of islanders who really want to push this in their local community. So as we discuss transportation in this state, a lot of that is focused on, you know, gas taxes and different types of lanes and all of this, these other different initiatives. But when I think, you know, about the uniqueness of my district, the thing that's on the forefront of my mind is how do we transition these boats that emit and use a whole lot of fossil fuels, how do we transition them to electric? And so that's something that we're going to be working on.
So I have a page of I have like 2 pages of really excellent questions, but we don't have time for all of those. So in 30 seconds or less, I need each of you to say one thing that folks in this room should take away from this discussion with regard to how we as residents of Massachusetts can move bold climate action along to mobilize everyone to make sure that Massachusetts is leading by example. 30 seconds per person. I'm nothing if not efficient, right, Larry?
So I think my thing would be talk to your decision makers. So whether that's at the local level or the state level, which you'll get a chance to do at lunch, I assume. But I think talk to your boards of selectmen, show up for town meeting, and make your voices heard that you want a total climate solution as fast as possible.
I think we heard Dr. Carter mention earlier that it's not one thing, it's not one policy, it's not one person that can change the discussion or solve the issues that we have. And so I'm pleased to announce that we're going to continue this conversation, and this is an issue that really warrants its own dedicated effort. And so we are hosting a series of community meetings at the end of this month where we want to continue this conversation around the data and have a fact-based conversation. And we look forward to working with you all in this room and invite you to participate in those meetings. We have several staff here, and we'd be happy to share the details about those meetings so that we can really work together to form a larger Cape Cod Climate Initiative.
All the planning that the state can do really is just planning. We really do need a lot of local collaboration, but also it boils down to consumer preferences and consumer decisions. And so in my 30 seconds, I would say really, look at your building, your residential building, see if you can do heat pumps instead of replacing your gas furnace with another gas furnace. And then look at your cars. Can you buy an EV vehicle? I know the state rebate program is down, but there are still the federal incentives, so my husband and I, we took advantage of that. So really look at that, and then talk to your family members. I talked to my in-laws, and they're like, oh, I did not know that my driving to the grocery store emit greenhouse gas emissions, and over time, it has contributed to 40% more of the greenhouse emissions in the state. So really, you know, look at your decision that you're doing every day and talk to your family and friends.
I would just really emphasize in advocating for whether it's legislation or action at the local level or regional level is and I know that Janet Williams emphasized this, is from an make sure to have an equity lens, is making sure that everyone is benefiting from solar, clean energy policy, job creation, you know, who is suffering from the most negative impacts of fossil fuels. Really make sure there's that equity lens, because unfortunately that's something that Massachusetts has not done a good job on, and we really need to make sure that, you know, everyone is benefiting from these policies. It also builds political support for stronger action as well. So please be sure to emphasize that. Thanks.
I'm going to give you two. At the local level, there's actually a provision that we created through this environmental bond bill for towns to have intermunicipal sustainability coordinators. It was specifically designed for small communities like we have here on Cape Cod. Hasn't been adopted yet, and it's a really easy tool that our communities should be using. Would probably cost them, by the way, they're getting a bunch of extra money on the short-term rental tax, so they got a bunch of free cash, so they can pay for this. So check this out, sustainability coordinator piece. I think it would make a big difference in moving things forward at the local level. More broadly at the state level, y'all need to be holding us accountable on revenue. And being like, we need to create, have a revenue stream for us, yes, to adapt and address this, and also having revenue tied to putting a price on carbon. So I know folks don't like to talk about revenue or lest I say the word taxes, but that needs to be a tool here. And I think if we're not talking about that, we're leaving a big piece on the table.
I would echo what Ms. Chu said, and also add that if you get your energy through the Cape Light Compact, switch to their they're 100% in quotations renewable program from New England renewable sources. It costs slightly more, but that ensures that those renewable sources that are powering your energy come from New England and come from new sources. The only other thing I'd add, because everything else has been said, is that, you know, when you look at deep water offshore wind, we're not going to hit our energy goals unless we get that up and running. The one thing holding that up right now is the President of the United States. That's the only thing holding this up. He doesn't care about the environment. He's just holding up an environmental impact statement because it's wind and not oil and gas. And Zinke, the former Interior Secretary, was really for deep water offshore wind. And why this all died and why this is being held out is because now there's Bernhardt, who literally came from the oil and gas industry. There's no mystery here. It's just being held up, not for any good type of policy, just because it's not oil and gas. So, one, do everything that these guys said, and then two, in your spare time, maybe like take a trek up to New Hampshire and go knock some doors for whoever the Democratic nominee is, because that's really, as long as President Trump is president, I don't think we're going to have, I think they're going to continue to hold up offshore wind off of our coast.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking our panelists.
We're going to take a 15-minute break. If you could plan to be back in your seats in 15 minutes. Thank you.